Welcome to Commons and Chronicles, the podcast where we talk about all the best Creative Commons and reusable open game license content. If you need resources for your creative writing, game design, or you just love lore, Commons and Chronicles is for you. Hi everyone, it's Klaatu, and in this episode I want to expound upon something that I alluded to in a previous episode and promised to get back to, so this is the fulfillment of that promise. The thing that I am talking about is page 299 of the 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons Player's Handbook. This is a page in Appendix B, wherein the authors provide a bunch of different pantheons for you to use in a game. And one of those pantheons, I mean, some of those pantheons are D&D, Wizards of the Coast, TSR specific, like Forgotten Realms, that's kind of famous and not exactly open content. Greyhawk, again, famous, not open. Dragonlance, very famous, not open. So all those things are great to have because they're a lot of fun. They're great pantheons. A lot of people know and love those pantheons. But what's really interesting is that in this same appendix, they give some historical pantheons, like the Greek pantheon, the Celtic pantheon, the Norse pantheon, and Egyptian pantheon. So I want to talk about the Egyptian one, not only because I've been talking a lot about Lovecraft lately, as you may have noticed, but Lovecraft, of course, is quite taken with the Egyptian deities. I mean, the influence is pretty obvious, and if you read more Lovecraft than just the book that we've been covering on this podcast so far, The Dream Quest of the Unknown Kadeth, if you read more, then you'll find that Lovecraft set quite a few things in Egypt, and I think it's pretty obvious, yeah, that he was kind of interested in the whole Egyptian mythos. I want to talk about Egypt also because of all of the mythologies out there, it's certainly, for me, it was the other pantheon. It was the other mythology. Like, in school, we always learned about, in American schools, we always learned about the Greek mythology, the Mount Olympus and the gods there. And you by the end of your schooling, you knew that pretty well. You were pretty familiar with the Greek gods and the demigods and how they were related and what kind of fighting they had amongst each other and all those things. We got a pretty good lesson on that, I think, all around. I don't know why we didn't get as much discussion about the ancient religion of Egypt, but we didn't. But I was always intrigued by it, and I've done a little bit of, I wouldn't go so far as to call it research, but I've read stuff on it. And in this episode, I will be drawing bits and pieces of knowledge from two different books. One is called The Egyptian Myth, A Very Short Introduction. That was written by Geraldine Pinch, and it was published by the Oxford University Press. The other one that I will be drawing from for just kind of background on Egypt, on ancient Egypt, is Exploring Religion in Ancient Egypt by Stephen Quirk, and that was published by Wiley Press. Now, it doesn't really matter all that much, I mean, what I'm drawing from, because ultimately the authority in this discussion is the Player's Handbook. Now, the Player's Handbook really only gives a table of about maybe 12 different gods, the suggested alignment and domains, and then some kind of associated symbol. So it doesn't give a whole lot of information, but it does, it sets these gods up so that they fit into an RPG framework. So I don't want to, I don't need to, but I don't want to either, go too deeply into the Egyptian gods as they are presented in traditional Egyptian mythology, because that doesn't always line up 100% with the D&D interpretation of them. Then again, that said, and in the defense of Dungeons and Dragons, the Egyptian mythology is really, really all over the place. again, if you're familiar, if you're used to something like the Greek mythologies, then you might not be able to name a specific canonical source text for those stories, but we all kind of have the same story in our minds. And certainly with something more mainstream like Christianity, you can point, or Judaism even, you can point to a text. You can say, that's the place where I go for all the authoritative information about this pantheon. Ancient Egyptian mythology is not quite so clear-cut. Of course, I'm not a scholar on ancient Egypt, but the books that I've read have explained it in this way. The ancient Egyptian religion sprang up quite organically across a pretty vast expanse. I mean, Egypt was big, and it wasn't just Egypt. I mean, there were lots of empires kind of in that fertile crescent, as they called it in school. You know, there's Egypt, there's Nubia, there's other places that I don't know because I'm not a historian. So there were all of these different regions. And each different region, or even just, like, don't even think of it as a region, even just, there are towns, different towns, and each town would have its own god that would kind of crop up out of local legend. And this is a long time ago. There wasn't really that easy to just walk over to another town and sort of ask, hey, what kind of gods do you have over here? You know, they grew up independently of one another, and then as the towns did become coordinated and sort of cross-culture sharing started to happen, those gods would sometimes merge. If they were overlapping a lot, they would just kind of merge into one, or maybe a pharaoh would rise to power and decide that they're really fond of this god, so all the other gods that were around that area that sort of served the same purpose kind of got merged into that god. So you have a lot of composite gods, you have a lot of overlap, you have a lot of competition for space. It gets pretty confusing, to be honest, and you can thank me later for saving you the trouble of cross-referencing page 299 out of the Player's Handbook with several different Wikipedia pages on several different gods, which you will soon start to realize offer a lot of conflicting stories about the same characters. But that's just how it was. That was the nature of how the religion grew and evolved. So starting at the top, the first god that we have got is Ra-Harakhti. Ra-Harakhti is the god of the sun, the ruler of all gods, alignment lawful good. Suggested domains are life and light. Symbol is a solar disk encircled by a serpent. So Ra-Harakhti is actually, as I was sort of just indicating, is actually a composite god. So Ra started out as just Ra. That was the god of the sun. And later, Ra became somewhat combined with another god called Horus, and then later also got combined with Amun. You may have even heard of Amun-Ra. I feel like that's a pretty popular one. Either way, this is a sun god. It's a pretty major god. He's a benevolent god. He's super nice. He's one of the good guys. I mean, he's lawful good, so obviously he's one of the good guys. He is the, by some accounts, the creator of everything. He may not have been created himself. He may have just come from into being, just as is. Or, depending on what cult you belong to, he may have been created by Ptah, who is a different god, who we will actually talk about later. So it kind of depends on who you're asking as to whether Ra is the start of everything or just one of the gods, a god who was created and then created everything. It is pretty widely accepted that he had a hand in creation, though, and it is said that he called life into existence, I mean, after, so he didn't create the world. The world may have been created by some other god, or it may have just kind of been created out of nothingness. And by nothingness, I actually mean sort of a liquid darkness. It's kind of, the idea, at least, is that I've heard, is that the Nile itself, or some super Nile, some kind of spiritual form of the Nile, gave birth to all of the land. And when the land was born, earth was born, the sun rose. And that sun, of course, was Ra. And then Ra spoke the secret names for all the things that now exist. And by speaking their secret names, they came into existence. Ra had a major cult in a city called Heliopolis, which is actually a Greek word for Helio is sun, Polis is city, so Heliopolis is the city of the sun. His rituals would include things like hymns and incantations or spells and prayers. He's a pretty wholesome guy. He doesn't demand anything horrible like sacrifice or even gifts. He just kind of wants worship. So in 3.5 edition, you might add domains for him, such as good, maybe law, maybe something like liberation, something like that, or glory, possibly. So yeah, he's a very good and kind of positive figure. He's not really guilty of anything horrendous. You know how in the Greek pantheon, there's a lot of times things that Zeus does that kind of make you think that maybe Zeus isn't the best leader that you could possibly have at the head of your pantheon. Ra isn't really like that. He's a pretty good guy all around. I mean, there might be some small myths floating around there that I haven't heard of that have him doing terrible things, but I don't know of those. He seems like a pretty good guy to me. Now, he's also got a wife or a consort, and that's another thing that's confusing in the Egyptian mythology, is exactly the relationships of one god to another, because the language is, well, first of all, the language is being transcribed from a bunch of other stuff, and the sources tend to be either directly from literally pyramid walls, like inscriptions that are written on the sides of tombs and things, which are supposed to be sort of spells to keep evil away, or they are transcribed from Greek historians who wrote about Egypt when Greece was, you know, when Greeks would go down to Egypt and learn about the culture. And a lot of times those accounts were a lot different, maybe, than what you would find in the Egyptian accounts, or the actual myths. So that gets confusing. So he had some kind of consort, wife, daughter, sister, we don't know. It's just kind of this other version of Ra called Rait Tawe. Raet-Tawy. And the reason I mention this character is because if you didn't want Ra to be the overfather, but instead be an overmother, you could just swap out Ratitawe with Ra Horakhti, and you'd suddenly have a supreme benevolent god who was a female instead of a male, which I think a lot of times makes a lot of sense in a lot of mythologies. I would also say that Ra would probably have been, or could, you could add the domain of royalty to Ra in 3.5, because the kings of Egypt, the pharaohs, were said to be sons of Ra. So it was kind of this kind of God-granted power that pharaohs existed. Okay, so that's Ra Horakhti. I'm going to skip down in the table a little bit just to stay with the lawful good alignment. and go down to Osiris, who is according to this table, Osiris is the god of nature and the underworld. Lawful good. It's not all that often that you get a god of the underworld classified as a lawful good god, so that's kind of interesting to me. Domains. Suggested domains, life and nature. And his symbol is the crook and flail. So Osiris, the influence and impact of Osiris cannot be overstated. Osiris was huge. He was a really popular god. He became almost, he was so popular that he almost overshadowed a bunch of other gods. Like, he was huge. And the weird thing is that he's most famous, really, I think, for dying, getting chopped into pieces, actually. So Osiris is a creator god as well. So Osiris's followers were pretty sure that Osiris actually created everything. And if I recall correctly, it was from Osiris's tears that everything sprang up. Could be getting that a little bit wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's correct. Either way, Osiris was basically the Ra of his followers. And like I say, in the ancient Egyptian religion, there's a lot of overlap. So Osiris, I don't know if he was a competitor to Ra in terms of what people wanted to believe, or if he just sprang up independently of Ra, and the two cities or the two regions that worshipped either Ra or Osiris just never really combined them. I'm not really sure. But Osiris was a big deal, and he's an old god. Again, not sure who created Osiris. Legend, or myth, rather, says that he may have been the son of Geb, which is kind of considered sort of the spirit of Earth, and Nut, which is considered the spirit of the sky, more or less. So, possibly, he is a child of Earth and Sky. And I know what you're thinking, how can you be the child of Earth and Sky if you also created Earth and Sky? Well, I didn't really ever find any of the Egyptian gods who actually created the planet. And I don't know for a fact that Egyptians even understood that it was a planet. So I don't know that theory ever really came about. Generally, what I was finding is that the world, and by world I mean both the planet itself and the atmosphere and everything, kind of created itself or rose out of something, and then the big god who came along at the same time created all the stuff on the planet. So the humans and the cows and the crocodiles and snakes and things like that. Okay, so Osiris's deal, and the major sort of mythological story that a lot of the modern things sort of hinge upon is Osiris's story. Or you could call it Seth's story or Isis's story, but it's kind of this Osiris tale that has appeared in a couple of different places in very different forms. So the story itself changes depending on who's telling it, and a couple of different people have told it. The one who signed his name to it was Plutarch, who was a Greek, I guess, historian, I guess you'd call him. I don't know if that's what he called himself, but he wrote stuff down a long time ago, so he's a Greek historian now. And he tells this story one way. Now, finding texts in Egyptian tombs and other places, you'll get a slightly different version of the story. What we do know is that Osiris insulted Seth. Seth is a god who we'll get to in a minute, but he's the god of chaos, essentially. So Osiris insults Seth in some way. We're not really sure how. Maybe they got into a fight. Maybe Osiris had sex with Nephthys, who was the consort of Seth. It kind of depends on who's telling the story. But anyway, Seth becomes really, really angry with Osiris. In fact, he gets so angry that he becomes completely consumed with the need to take revenge. He spends a lot of time trying to take revenge on Osiris. He hatches a bunch of schemes, they don't work, and then finally he manages to kill Osiris. And there are, again, a couple of different ways that he actually manages to do this. A lot of times it's just pure rage, he just manages to kill him. Other times it's more trick-based. Like in one story, I think it's the Plutarch version, Seth builds this crate, a crate is what you would call it, I wouldn't want to call it a coffin, but some kind of box. And it's a beautiful box, and he says he's going to give it to anyone who can fit inside the box. And nobody can fit inside it, except, what are the chances? Osiris. So Osiris climbs in and says, hey, look, I fit, everybody. So Seth then closes the box, locks it, and dumps his body into the Nile. Lots of different things happen in the Nile, again, depending on who you ask. Parts of Osiris's body is potentially bitten off, some rather important parts in some versions of the stories, and the Nile itself becomes kind of a symbol of something sacred. If you drown in the Nile, if you fall into the Nile and you die, then it's a good way to go, because that's the Nile, that's where Osiris died. Good on you, that's a great way to die. So Osiris is, from what I understand, resurrected at some point. So then Seth comes up and chops his body into several pieces. And the number of pieces varies on the stories that you read. It's anywhere from like 14 to 42. It's just, you know, he chops it up, chops the body up, scatters the pieces around the kingdom. This is kind of the basis of Egypt existing, or it's considered almost a blessing that Osiris's body has been distributed among the kingdom, in other words. Well, Osiris's wife, Isis, is really, really sad. So she and her sister happens to be Nephthys, who happens to be the lady, or the goddess who Osiris potentially had sex with, and got Seth angry. So Seth and Nephthys are together. Isis and Osiris are together. Isis and Nephthys are pals. And apparently Osiris and Nephthys are pals too. But anyway, so Isis and Nephthys go around and gather all the pieces of Osiris's body, the pieces of his body together, and they put him back together. They reassemble him, and they revive him long enough for Isis to become impregnated with Horus. And Horus is a god who, again, we will actually speak about. No, we won't. He's not on this table. But he'll come up again, I promise. But he's already come up, because remember, Horus was a god who got sort of merged with Ra. So Ra, Harakhthi, actually partly consists of Horus, but in this story, Horus is just Horus. He's just the son of Isis and sort of dead Osiris. And then Osiris apparently dies again, and because, I mean, you can't live for that long when your body has been chopped into pieces. So he dies again, and he kind of moves on to become the ruler of the underworld. And that is indeed why he is listed undoubtedly as the god of the underworld in the player's handbook, even though he is lawful good, which, as I say, that I feel like that's a little bit unusual, because usually the underworld is a place of evil and darkness and death. Well, it's still of death, but there's that unique Egyptian trait of death not really being all that bad. It's not really an evil thing, it's just part of the life cycle. So that's Osiris. And so those are your two lawful good gods. There's Ra Harakhthi, lawful good, creator of all things, kind of a sun god, and then there's Osiris, god of nature, god of the underworld, and all around good guy, just kind of, maybe he cheated a little bit with someone's wife, and maybe he got killed for it. But hey, now he's hanging out in the underworld, and he's fine. Now, you're going to find, actually, that a lot of gods in the Egyptian pantheon hang around in the underworld. It's kind of a popular place, to be honest, so I'm gonna kind of minimize that in this overview, because it really does feel like all the gods either escort your soul after death into the underworld, or they're hanging out in the underworld, or they protect the underworld, or they rule over the underworld. It's just lots of underworld stuff going on. Okay, next up, let's see on the chart here is Anubis. Hey, speaking of the underworld. So this guy is a lawful neutral god, Anubis. He's the god of judgment and death, lawful neutral. His suggested domain is death, and his symbol is the black jackal. Anubis, if you don't like Egyptology and you don't really pay attention to it, you probably still know Anubis. Like, I feel like Anubis is one of the more famous representations of an Egyptian god that you're going to come across. He's kind of right up there with the Sphinx and pyramids. This jackal, this person with a jackal head, really, really popular. And it turns out that he is a god of afterlife. He's the god of mummification. He is essentially the god of what we would call repose in the Dungeons and Dragons world. And in fact, in the 3.5 edition of Dungeons and Dragons Pathfinder, there is a domain specifically designed for repose, which is, you see death not as something to be feared, but as a final rest and reward for a life well spent. The taint of undeath is a mockery of what you hold dear. And it's essentially, the idea of repose is that you protect something against decay after death. So death is more of a repose than falling apart. So that's repose. I would personally add that domain to Anubis if I were playing Anubis, or if I was playing with this pantheon in a 3.5 campaign setting. So he's the guardian of the dead. He is also the judge of the dead, and you probably have heard this before, maybe, but the way that Egyptian souls were judged was that they would weigh their heart. And if their heart was lighter than the feather of truth, then they could proceed. And if not, then they were doomed. So that's Anubis. He doesn't really do a whole lot for being a really, really famous god. He's very focused. He does one thing, and that is that he deals with dead things. And this is, I mean, it's perfect for his alignment to be lawful neutral, I feel, because that's just kind of, that's exactly what a lawful neutral god should be, I think. So speaking of lawful neutral, we have another lawful neutral god called Ptah. And I mentioned Ptah before in the Ra Harakhti segment. Ptah is, according to some people, the creator of everything. He apparently thought everything into existence. So he conceived everything by thought, and he made it exist by speaking the word. This is kind of similar to how Ra Harakhti was supposed to have created everything, if you really think about it. I mean, Ra Harakhti spoke the secret names of all the things that now exist. And that's kind of what Ptah did. He thought about these things, and then he spoke the words to make them exist. Lots of overlap in this pantheon. Now, I don't know of any myth version of these myths that have Ptah being parented by anyone. So he may be the oldest god in this pantheon. He might not be, but as far as I could tell, he doesn't have any parents. He created basically himself. So to me, he's got to be the oldest god. And maybe he's the one. Maybe he's the god who brought, you know, the actual, like, if Ra or Osiris created the things on the earth. Maybe it's Ptah that created the earth and substance, essentially. It's up to you, obviously, but that's kind of how I see it. Now Ptah, interestingly, is seen as the cause of earthquakes. He has a domain of essentially the artifice domain, and I think that exists both in 5 and 3.5. And as such, he is the patron god of things like metallurgy, blacksmithing, sculpture, craftsmanship of all kinds, carpentry, stuff like that. He is also often depicted as a dwarf, so it's kind of perfect for a fantasy world. If your dwarf culture needs a god, you look no further than Ptah. I mean, Ptah is perfect for a dwarven god. He does all of the things that dwarves love to do. He's very much associated with the earth. For me, even more so, because I mean, yeah, he is kind of known as an earthquake god, but he's also, for me at least, since there are so many competing gods in the space of who created everything, I just kind of think of Ptah as that eldest god who created all the things that we exist on and under. He may have created Ra himself. It kind of depends on who you ask. And he is represented by three symbols, which are power, life, and stability. So he's a very kind of solid, stable god. He doesn't, again, just kind of like Ra and even Anubis, it's not a whole lot of drama going on in their lives, in their stories. He is what he is. He's this god, he created stuff, and that's what he is. Now, he also listens to prayers, famously. He's supposed to be a very good god for that sort of thing, like for talking to. He actually listens to prayers. His temples often had ears, like sculpted ears, or maybe they're inscribed in the walls, I'm not sure. But yeah, his temples were very frequently proclaiming how he'll listen to you. And I guess in a big pantheon with lots of competing gods, you don't necessarily always find someone who wants to bother with you. Maybe they're too busy killing another god who slept with their wife, for instance. So that's what Ptah kind of is known for. And because he's such a big deal, he's such a stable and listening god, they give him the knowledge domain in the 5th edition Player's Handbook. Like I said, if I was playing in 3.5, I would add artifice, but certainly knowledge gives your cleric various things like command, identify at first level, some cool things like speaking with the dead at 5th level, arcane eye, confusion at 7th, and then legend, lore, and scrying at 9. So it's not a bad domain to have. It's kind of one of those big, robust domains, as if though your god had thought everything into existence and then realized them with a word. So that's Ptah, the lawful neutral god, or the other lawful neutral god, the other being, if you'll recall, Anubis. So now let's finish this episode up with lawful evil. And lawful evil would be the god Sobek. Sobek is a crocodile god. He is a god of military strength, of power, and of water, so probably naval power as well. Water, in general, the Nile was his. I mean, that he was kind of a god of the Nile in ancient Egypt. Whether you have a Nile in your campaign setting or not depends, but some great river, some great body of water, he would have dominion over that. He is, like I say, a crocodile god. He often appears as a crocodile, or he has a crocodile head with horns and plumes, according to the handbook. So he's the god of water and crocodiles, lawful evil. His domains are nature and tempest. In ancient Egypt, he was known to be a fierce and animalistic god. He was very, very ferocious, I guess, but what's the word? I guess maybe primal. He was known for taking what he wanted, in every sense of that phrase. He's a barbaric god, essentially. The rituals that you would give him were typically offerings of something, not like human sacrifice or anything, but you would want to give him things to basically satiate his appetite, is the impression I get from their offerings. He's an interesting one because he really kind of does feel like he is a reptilian god. He has the head of a crocodile, but he feels like a reptilian god. When you put him into a D&D setting, you really kind of feel like, yeah, this is very... I could see Sobek being the god of kobolds, of dragonkind, of dragons, that sort of thing. And certainly of barbarians as well, because he is really brutal. I mean, he's not... In the mythology, he's not what I would call evil, actually. He's just... I mean, in D&D, Player's Handbook, he is lawful evil. I'm just saying his reputation in the historical mythology, I wouldn't call him a very evil god. He's just a god to be respected and feared in the religious sense. And that's Sobek. I don't have a whole lot of stories about Sobek. That's just his reputation. He's a fearsome, powerful god that you don't want to cross, and that you would want to invoke when you're going into a situation where you need strength, might, power, and so on. And that's all of the lawful block. That's the lawful good, lawful neutral, and lawful evil gods within the Egyptian pantheon. So, as written by the handbook. So, in the next episode, we will cover the neutral and the chaotic sides of the pantheon, and then we'll be done with the Egyptian pantheon in the Player's Handbook. So thanks for listening, and tune in next time for more Armchair Egyptology. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as Not Klaatu. I'm on the Freenode network. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.